touch that, I thought.
Well, it's possible. There's no pretending that it will be easy to let now. Servants and all that, you know. If you like the place, after you've seen it, I should advise you to make an offer. Shall I write you out an order?
If you please. A quarter of an hour later, I was at the lodge of the Mill House. In answer to my knock, the door flew open and a tall, middle-aged woman literally bounced out.
Nobody can go into the house, do you hear that? Fairly sick of you reporters, I am. Sir Eustace's orders are...
I understood the house was to let, I said freezingly, holding out my order. Of course, if it's already taken...
Oh, I'm sure I beg your pardon, miss. I've been fairly pestered with these newspaper people. Not a minute's peace. No, the house isn't let, nor likely to be now.
Are the drains wrong? I asked in an anxious whisper.
Oh, Lord, miss, the drains is all right. But surely you've heard about the foreign lady as was done to death here?
I believe I did read something about it in the papers, I said carelessly. My indifference piqued the good woman. If I had betrayed any interest, she would probably have closed up like an oyster. As it was, she positively bridled.
I should say you did, miss. It's been in all the newspapers. The Daily Budget's out still to catch the man who did it. It seems, according to them, as our police are no good at all, well, I hope they'll get him. Although, a nice-looking fellow he was, and no mistake. A kind of soldierly look about him. Ah, well, I dare say he'd been wounded in the war, and sometimes they go a bit queer afterwards.
My sister's boy did. Perhaps she'd used him bad. They're a bad lot, those foreigners. Though she was a fine-looking woman, stood there where you're standing now. Was she dark or fair? I ventured. You can't tell from these newspaper portraits.
Dark hair and a very white face. Too white for nature, I thought. Had her lips red and something cruel.
I don't like to see it. A little powder now and then is quite another thing. We were conversing like old friends now. I put another question. Did she seem nervous or upset at all?
Not a bit. She was smiling to herself. Quite like... as though she was amused at something. That's why you could have knocked me down with a feather when, the next afternoon, those people came running out calling for the police and saying there'd been a murder done. I shall never get over it. And as for setting foot in that house after dark, I wouldn't do it. Not if it was ever so. Why, I wouldn't even stay here at the lodge if Sir Eustace hadn't been down on his bended knees to me.
I thought Sir Eustace Pedler was at Cannes.
So he was, miss. He came back to England when he heard the news. And, as to the bended knees, that was a figure of speech. His secretary, Mr. Padgett, having offered us double pay to stay on, and, as my John says, money is money nowadays.
I concurred heartily with John's by no means original remarks. The young man now, said Mrs. James, reverting suddenly to a former point in the conversation, he was upset. His eyes, light eyes they were, I noticed them particular, was all shining, excited, I thought, but I never dreamt of anything being wrong, not even when he came out again, looking all queer.
How long was he in the house?
Oh, not long, a matter of 5 minutes, maybe.
How tall was he, do you think?
About 6 foot?
I should say so, maybe.
He was clean-shaven, you say?
Yes, miss, not even one of these toothbrush moustaches.
Was his chin all shiny? I asked on a sudden impulse.
Mrs. James stared at me with awe.
Well, now you come to mention it, miss, it was.
However did you know? It's a curious thing, but murderers often have shiny chins, I explained wildly.
Mrs. James accepted the statement in all good faith.
Really? Now, miss, I never heard that before.
You didn't notice what kind of head he had, I suppose?
Just the ordinary kind, miss. I'll fetch you the keys, shall I?
I accepted them and went on my way to the Mill House. My reconstruction so far I considered good. All along, I had realised that the difference between the man Mrs. James had described and my tube doctor were those of non-essentials. An overcoat, a beard, gold-rimmed eyeglasses. The doctor had appeared middle-aged, but I remembered that he had stooped over the body like a comparatively young man. There had been a suppleness which told of young joints. The victim of the accident, the mothball man, as I called him to myself, and the foreign woman, Mrs. de Castina, or whatever her real name was, had had an assignation to meet at the mill house. That was how I pieced the thing together, either because they feared they were being watched, or for some other reason. They chose the rather ingenious method of both getting an order to view the same house. Thus, their meeting there might have the appearance of pure chance. That the mothball man had suddenly caught sight of the doctor, and that the meeting was totally unexpected and alarming to him, was another fact of which I was fairly sure. What had happened next? The doctor had removed his disguise and followed the woman to Marlowe. But it was possible that had he removed it rather hastily, traces of spirit gum might still linger on his chin. Hence my question to Mrs. James. Whilst occupied with my thoughts, I had arrived at the low, old-fashioned door of the mill house. Unlocking it with the key, I passed inside. The hall was low and dark, and the place smelt forlorn and mildewy. In spite of myself, I shivered. Did the woman who had come here smiling to herself a few days ago feel no chill of premonition as she entered this house? I wondered, did the smile fade from her lips, and did a nameless dread close round her heart? Or had she gone upstairs, smiling still, unconscious of the doom that was so soon to overtake her? My heart beat a little faster. Was the house really empty? Was doom waiting for me in it also? For the first time, I understood the meaning of the much-used word atmosphere. There was an atmosphere in this house, an atmosphere of cruelty, of menace, of evil. Chapter 7. Shaking off the feelings that oppressed me, I went quickly upstairs. I had no difficulty in finding the room of the tragedy. On the day the body was discovered, it had rained heavily, and large muddy boots had trampled the uncarpeted floor in every direction. I wondered if the murderer had left any footmarks the previous day. It was likely that the police would be reticent on the subject if he had, but on consideration I decided it was unlikely. The weather had been fine and dry. There was nothing of interest about the room. It was almost square, with two big bay windows, plain white walls and a bare floor, the boards being stained round the edges where the carpet had ceased. I searched it carefully, but there was not so much as a pin lying about. The gifted young detective did not seem likely to discover a neglected clue. I had brought with me a pencil and notebook. There did not seem much to note, but I duly dotted down a brief sketch of the room to cover my disappointment at the failing of my quest. As I was in the act of returning the pencil to my bag, it slipped from my fingers and rolled along the floor. The mill house was really old, and the floors were very uneven. The pencil rolled steadily, with increasing momentum, until it came to rest under one of the windows. In the recess of each window there was a broad window seat, underneath which there was a cupboard. My pencil was lying right against the cupboard door. The cupboard was shut, but it suddenly occurred to me that if it had been open, my pencil would have rolled inside. I opened the door, and my pencil immediately rolled in and sheltered modestly in the farthest corner. I retrieved it, noting as I did so that owing to lack of light and the peculiar formation of the cupboard, one could not see it, but had to feel for it. Apart from my pencil, the cupboard was empty, but being thorough by nature, I tried the one under the opposite window. At first sight, it looked as though that also was empty, but I grubbed about perseveringly and was rewarded by feeling my hand close on a hard paper cylinder which lay in a sort of trough or depression in the far corner of the cupboard. As soon as I had it in my hand, I knew what it was, a roll of Kodak films. Here was a find. I realized, of course, that these films might very well be an old roll belonging to Sir Eustace Pedler, which had rolled in here and had not been found when the cupboard was emptied. But I did not think so. The red paper was far too fresh-looking. It was just as dusty as it would have been had it lain there for 2 or 3 days. That is to say, since the murder. Had it been there for any length of time, it would have been thickly coated. Who had dropped it? The woman or the man? I remembered that the contents of her handbag had appeared to be intact. If it had been jerked open in the struggle and the roll of films had fallen out, surely some of the loose money would have been scattered about also. No, it was not the woman who had dropped the films. I sniffed suddenly and suspiciously. Was the smell of mothballs becoming an obsession with me? I could swear that the roll of film smelt of it also. I held them under my nose. They had, as usual, a strong smell of their own. But apart from that, I could clearly detect the odour I disliked so much. I soon found the cause. A minute thread of cloth had caught on a rough edge of the centre wood, and that shred was strongly impregnated with mothballs. At some time or another, the films had been carried in the overcoat of the man who was killed in the tube. Was it he who had dropped them here? Hardly. His movements were all accounted for. No, it was the other man, the doctor. He had taken the films when he had taken the paper. It was he who had dropped them here during his struggle with the woman. I had got my clue. I would have the role developed, and then I would have further developments to work upon. Very elated, I left the house, returned the keys to Mrs. James, and made my way as quickly as possible to the station. On the way back to town, I took out my paper and studied it afresh. Suddenly the figures took on a new significance. Suppose they were a date. 17/1/22. The 17th of January, 1922. Surely that must be it. Idiot that I was not to have thought of it before. But in that case, I must find out the whereabouts of Kilmorden Castle, for today was actually the 14th. 3 days. Little enough. Almost hopeless when one had no idea of where to look. It was too late to hand in my roll today. I had to hurry home to Kensington so as not to be late for dinner. It occurred to me that there was an easy way of verifying whether some of my conclusions were correct. I asked Mr. Fleming whether there had been a camera amongst the dead man's belongings. I knew that he had taken an interest in the case and was conversant with all the details. To my surprise and annoyance, he replied that there had been no camera. All Carton's effects had been gone over very carefully in the hopes of finding something that might throw light upon his state of mind. He was positive that there had been no photographic apparatus of any kind. That was rather a setback to my theory. If he had no camera, why should he be carrying a roll of films? I set out early next morning to take my precious roll to be developed. I was so fussy that I went all the way to Regent Street to the big Kodak place. I handed it in and asked for a print of each film. The man finished stacking together a heap of films packed in yellow tin cylinders for the tropics and picked up my roll. He looked at me. "You've made a mistake, I think," he said, smiling. "Oh, no," I said. "I'm sure I haven't."
"You've given me the wrong roll. This is an unexposed one."
I walked out with what dignity I could muster. I dare say it is good for one now and again to realise what an idiot one can be, but nobody relishes the process. And then, just as I was passing one of the big shipping offices, I came to a sudden halt. In the window was a beautiful model of one of the company's boats, and it was labelled Kenilworth Castle. A wild idea shot through my brain. I pushed the door open and went in. I went up to the counter, and in a faltering voice, genuine this time, I murmured, "Kilmorden Castle?"
"On the 17th from Southampton. Cape Town, first or second class."
"How much is it?"
"First class, £87.
I interrupted him. The coincidence was too much for me, exactly the amount of my legacy. I would put all my eggs in one basket. "First class," I said. I was now definitely committed to the adventure. Chapter 8. Extracts from the diary of Sir Eustace Pedler, MP.
It was an extraordinary thing that I never seemed to get any peace. I am a man who likes a quiet life. I like my club, my rubber of bridge, a well-cooked meal, a sound wine. I like England in the summer and the Riviera in the winter. I have no desire to participate in sensational happenings. Sometimes, in front of a good fire, I do not object to reading about them in the newspaper, but that is as far as I am willing to go. My object in life is to be thoroughly comfortable. I have devoted a certain amount of thought and a considerable amount of money to further that end, and I cannot say that I always succeed. If things do not actually happen to me, they happen round me, and frequently, in spite of myself. I become involved. I hate being involved. All this because Guy Paget came into my bedroom this morning with a telegram in his hand and a face as long as a mute at a funeral. Guy Paget is my secretary, a zealous, painstaking, hard-working fellow, admirable in every respect. I know no one who annoys me more. For a long time I have been racking my brains as to how to get rid of him. But you cannot very well dismiss a secretary because he prefers work to play, likes getting up early in the morning, and has positively no vices. The only amusing thing about the fellow is his face. He has the face of a 14th-century poisoner, the sort of man the Borgias got to do their odd jobs for them. I wouldn't mind so much if Paget didn't make me work, too. My idea of work is something that should be undertaken lightly and airily, trifled with, in fact. I doubt if Guy Paget has ever trifled with anything in his life. He takes everything seriously. That is what makes him so difficult to live with. Last week, I had the brilliant idea of sending him off to Florence. He talked about Florence and how much he wanted to go there. "My dear fellow," I cried, "you should go tomorrow. I will pay all your expenses." January isn't the usual time for going to Florence, but it would be all one to Paget. I could imagine him going about guidebook in hand religiously doing all the picture galleries, and a week's freedom was cheap to me at the price. It has been a delightful week. I have done everything I wanted to and nothing that I did not want to do. But when I blinked my eyes open and perceived Paget standing between me and the light at the unearthly hour of 9 a.m. this morning, I realized that freedom was over. "My dear fellow," I said, "has the funeral already taken place, or is it for later in the morning?" Paget does not appreciate dry humor. He merely stared. "So you know, Sir Eustace." "Know what?" I said crossly. "From the expression on your face, I inferred that one of your near and dear relatives was to be interred this morning." Paget ignored the sally as far as possible. "I thought you couldn't know about this." He tapped the telegram. "I know you dislike being aroused early, but it is 9 o'clock. Paget insists on regarding 9 a.m. as practically the middle of the day. "And I thought that under the circumstances..." He tapped the telegram again. "What is that thing?" I asked. "It's a telegram from the police at Marlow. A woman has been murdered in your house." That aroused me in earnest. "What colossal cheek!" I exclaimed. "Why in my house? Who murdered her?"
"They don't say. I suppose we shall go back to England at once, Sir Eustace."
"You need suppose nothing of the kind. Why should we go back?"
"The police. What on earth have I to do with the police?" "Well, it is your house."
"That," I said, "appears to be more my misfortune than my fault."
Guy Paget shook his head gloomily. "It will have a very unfortunate effect upon the constituency," he remarked lugubriously.
"I don't see why it should have, and yet I have a feeling that in such matters Paget's instincts are always right.
On the face of it, a Member of Parliament will be none the less efficient because a stray young woman comes and gets herself murdered in an empty house that belongs to him. But there is no accounting for the view the respectable British public takes of a matter."
"She's a foreigner, too, and that makes it worse," continued Paget gloomily.
Again, I believe he is right. If it is disreputable to have a woman murdered in your house, it becomes more disreputable if the woman is a foreigner. Another idea struck me. Good heavens, I exclaimed. I hope this won't upset Caroline. Caroline is the lady who cooks for me. Incidentally, she is the wife of my gardener. What kind of a wife she makes, I do not know, but she is an excellent cook. James, on the other hand, is not a good gardener, but I support him in idleness and give him the lodge to live in solely on account of Caroline's cooking. I don't suppose she'll stay after this, said Paget. You always were a cheerful fellow, I said. I expect I shall have to go back to England. Paget clearly intends that I shall. And there is Caroline to pacify.
3 days later.
It is incredible to me that anyone who can get away from England in winter does not do so. It is an abominable climate. All this trouble is very annoying. The house agents say it will be next to impossible to let the Mill House after all the publicity. Caroline has been pacified, with double pay. We could have sent her a cable to that effect from Cannes. In fact, as I have said all along, there was no earthly purpose to serve by our coming over. I shall go back tomorrow.
1 day later.
Several very surprising things have occurred. To begin with, I met Augustus Milray, the most perfect example of an old ass the present government has produced. His manner oozed diplomatic secrecy as he drew me aside in the club into a quiet corner. He talked a good deal about South Africa and the industrial situation there, about the growing rumours of a strike on the Rand, of the secret causes actuating that strike. I listened as patiently as I could. Finally, he dropped his voice to a whisper and explained that certain documents had come to light which ought to be placed in the hands of General Smuts. "I've no doubt you're quite right," I said, stifling a yawn.
"But how are we to get them to him? Our position in the matter is delicate, very delicate."
"What's wrong with the post?" I said cheerfully. "Put a tuppenny stamp on and drop him in the nearest letterbox."
He seemed quite shocked at the suggestion.
"My dear peddler, the common post?"
It has always been a mystery to me why government employ king's messengers and draw such attention to their confidential documents.
If you don't like the post, send one of your own young fellows. He'll enjoy the trip.
Impossible, said Milray, wagging his head in a senile fashion.
There are reasons, my dear peddler.
I assure you, there are reasons.
Well, I said, rising, all this is very interesting, but I must be off.
1 minute, my dear peddler, 1 minute, I beg of you. Now tell me in confidence, is it not true that you intend visiting South Africa shortly yourself?
You have large interests in Rhodesia, I know, and the question of Rhodesia joining in the Union is one in which you have a vital interest. Well, I had thought of going out in about a month's time.
You could possibly make it sooner, this month, this week, in fact.
"I could," I said, eyeing him with some interest, "but I don't know that I particularly want to."
"You would be doing the government a great service, a very great service. You would not find them ungrateful."
"Meaning you want me to be the postman?"
"Exactly. Your position is an unofficial one. Your journey is bona fide. Everything would be eminently satisfactory."
"Well," I said slowly, "I don't mind if I do. The one thing I am anxious to do is to get out of England again as soon as possible."
"You will find the climate of South Africa delightful, quite delightful."
"My dear fellow, I know all about the climate. I was out there shortly before the war."
"I am really much obliged to you, peddler. I will send you round the package by messenger, to be placed in General Smart's own hands, you understand? The Kilmorden Castle sails on Saturday. Quite a good boat."
I accompanied him a short way along Pall Mall before we parted. He shook me warmly by the hand and thanked me again effusively. I walked home, reflecting on the curious byways of governmental policy. It was the following evening that Jarvis, my butler, informed me that a gentleman wished to see me on private business, but declined to give his name. I have always a lively apprehension of insurance touts, so told Jarvis to say I could not see him. Guy Paget, unfortunately, when he might for once have been of real use, was laid up with a bilious attack. These earnest, hard-working young men with weak stomachs are always liable to bilious attacks. Jarvis returned. The gentleman asked me to tell you, Sir Eustace, that he comes to you from Mr. Milray. Well, that altered the complexion of things. A few minutes later, I was confronting my visitor in the library. He was a well-built young fellow with a deeply tanned face. A scar ran diagonally from the corner of his eye to the jaw, disfiguring what would otherwise have been a handsome, though somewhat reckless, countenance. Well, I said, what's the matter?
Mr. Milray sent me to you, Sir Eustace. I am to accompany you to South Africa as your secretary.
My dear fellow, I said, I've got a secretary already. I don't want another.
I think you do, Sir Eustace. Where is your secretary now?
He's down with a bilious attack, I explained.
Are you sure it's only a bilious attack?
Of course it is. He's subject to them.
My visitor smiled. It may or may not be a bilious attack. Time will show. But I will tell you this, Sir Eustace. Mr. Milray would not be surprised if an attempt were made to get your secretary out of the way. Oh, you need have no fear for yourself.
I suppose a momentary alarm had flickered across my face.
You are not threatened. Your secretary, out of the way, access to you would be easier. In any case, Mr. Milray wishes me to accompany you. The passage money will be our affair, of course, but you will take the necessary steps about the passport, as though you had decided that you needed the services of a second secretary.
He seemed a determined young man. We stared at each other, and he stared me down.
Very well, I said feebly.
You will say nothing to anyone as to my accompanying you.
Very well, I said again. After all, perhaps it was better to have this fellow with me, but I had a premonition that I was getting into deep waters, just when I thought I had attained peace. I stopped my visitor as he was turning to depart. It might be just as well if I knew my new secretary's name, I observed sarcastically. He considered for a minute.
Harry Raeburn seems quite a suitable name, he observed.
It was a curious way of putting it. Very well, I said for the third time.
Chapter 9. Anne's narrative resumed. It is most undignified for a heroine to be seasick. In books, the more it rolls and tosses, the better she likes it. When everybody else is ill, she alone staggers along the deck, braving the elements and positively rejoicing in the storm. I regret to say that at the first roll the Kilmorden gave, I turned pale and hastened below. A sympathetic stewardess received me. She suggested dry toast and ginger ale. I remained groaning in my cabin for 3 days. Forgotten was my quest. I had no longer any interest in solving mysteries. I was a totally different Anne to the one who had rushed back to the South Kensington Square so jubilantly from the shipping office. I smiled now as I remember my abrupt entry into the drawing room. Mrs. Fleming was alone there. She turned her head as I entered.
Is that you, Anne, my dear?
There is something I want to talk over with you.
Yes, I said, curbing my impatience.
Miss Emery is leaving.
Miss Emery was the governess.
As you have not yet succeeded in finding anything, I wondered if you would care. It would be so nice if you remained with us all together.
I was touched. She didn't want me, I knew. It was sheer Christian charity that prompted the offer. I felt remorseful for my secret criticism of her. Getting up, I ran impulsively across the room and flung my arms round her neck. You're a dear, I said. A dear, a dear, a dear. And thank you ever so much. But it's all right. I'm off to South Africa on Saturday. My abrupt onslaught had startled the good lady. She was not used to sudden demonstrations of affection. My words startled her still more.
To South Africa? My dear Anne, we would have to look into anything of that kind very carefully.
That was the last thing I wanted. I explained that I had already taken my passage, and that upon arrival I proposed to take up duties as a parlour maid. It was the only thing I could think of on the spur of the moment. There was, I said, a great demand for parlour maids in South Africa. I assured her that I was equal to taking care of myself, and in the end, with a sigh of relief at getting me off her hands, she accepted the project without further query. At parting, she slipped an envelope into my hand. Inside it, I found 5 new crisp 5-pound notes and the words, "I hope you will not be offended and will accept this with my love." She was a very good, kind woman. I could not have continued to live in the same house with her, but I did recognize her intrinsic worth. So here I was, with £25 in my pocket, facing the world and pursuing my adventure. It was on the fourth day that the stewardess finally urged me up on deck. Under the impression that I should die quicker below, I had steadfastly refused to leave my bunk. She now tempted me with the advent of Madeira. Hope rose in my breast. I could leave the boat and go ashore and be a parlourmaid there. Anything for dry land. Muffled in coats and rugs, and weak as a kitten on my legs, I was hauled up and deposited, an inert mass on a deck chair. I lay there with my eyes closed, hating life. The purser, a fair-haired young man with a round boyish face, came and sat down beside me. "Hello. Feeling rather sorry for yourself, eh?" "Yes," I replied, hating him.
"Ah, you won't know yourself in another day or two. We've had a rather nasty dusting in the bay, but there's smooth weather ahead. I'll be taking you on at Quoits tomorrow."
I did not reply.
"Think you'll never recover, eh? But I've seen people much worse than you, and 2 days later they were the life and soul of the ship. You'll be the same."
I did not feel sufficiently pugnacious to tell him outright that he was a liar. I endeavoured to convey it by a glance. He chatted pleasantly for a few minutes more, then he mercifully departed. People passed and repassed, brisk couples exercising, curvetting children, laughing young people. A few other pallid sufferers lay, like myself, in deck chairs. The air was pleasant, crisp, not too cold, and the sun was shining brightly. Insensibly, I felt a little cheered. I began to watch the people. One woman in particular attracted me. She was about 30, of medium height, and very fair, with a round, dimpled face and very blue eyes. Her clothes, though perfectly plain, had that indefinable air of cut about them which spoke of Paris. Also, in a pleasant but self-possessed way, she seemed to own the ship. Deck stewards ran to and fro obeying her commands. She had a special deck chair and an apparently inexhaustible supply of cushions. She changed her mind 3 times as to where she would like it placed. Throughout everything, she remained attractive and charming. She appeared to be one of those rare people in the world who know what they want, see that they get it, and manage to do so without being offensive. I decided that if ever I recovered, but of course I shouldn't, it would amuse me to talk to her. We reached Madeira about midday. I was still too inert to move, but I enjoyed the picturesque-looking merchants who came on board and spread their merchandise about the decks. There were flowers, too. I buried my nose in an enormous bunch of sweet, wet violets and felt distinctly better. In fact, I thought I might just possibly last out the end of the voyage. When my stewardess spoke of the attractions of a little chicken broth, I only protested feebly. When it came, I enjoyed it. My attractive woman had been ashore. She came back escorted by a tall, soldierly-looking man with dark hair and a bronzed face, whom I'd noticed striding up and down the deck earlier in the day. I put him down at once as one of the strong, silent men of Rhodesia. He was about 40, with a touch of greying hair at either temple, and was easily the best-looking man on board. When the stewardess brought me an extra rug, I asked her if she knew who my attractive woman was. "That's a well-known society lady, the Honourable Mrs. Clarence Blair. You must have read about her in the papers." I nodded, looking at her with renewed interest. Mrs. Blair was very well known indeed as one of the smartest women of the day. I observed with some amusement that she was the centre of a good deal of attention. Several people essayed to scrape acquaintance with the pleasant informality that boat allows. I admired the polite way that Mrs. Blair snubbed them. She appeared to have adopted the strong, silent man as her special cavalier, and he seemed duly sensible of the privilege accorded him. The following morning, to my surprise, after taking a few turns round the deck with her attentive companion, Mrs. Blair came to a halt by my chair.
"Feeling better this morning?"
I thanked her and said I felt slightly more like a human being.
"You did look ill yesterday. Colonel Race and I decided that we should have the excitement of a funeral at sea. But you've disappointed us."
I laughed. "Being up in the air has done me good."
"Nothing like fresh air," said Colonel Race, smiling.
"Being shut up in those stuffy cabins would kill anyone," declared Mrs. Blair, dropping into a seat by my side and dismissing her companion with a little nod. "You've got an outside one, I hope?"
I shook my head.
"My dear girl, why don't you change? There's plenty of room. A lot of people got off at Madeira, and the boat's very empty. Talk to the purser about it. He's a nice little boy. He changed me into a beautiful cabin because I didn't care for the one I've got. You talk to him at lunchtime when you go down."
I shuddered. I couldn't move.
"Don't be silly. Come and take a walk now with me."
She dimpled at me, encouraging me. I felt very weak on my legs at first, but as we walked briskly up and down, I began to feel a brighter and better being. After a turn or two, Colonel Race joined us again.
"You can see the Grand Peak of Tenerife from the other side."
"Can we? Can I get a photograph of it, do you think?"
"No, that won't deter you from snapping off at it."
Mrs. Blair laughed.
"You are unkind. Some of my photographs are very good."
"About 3% effective, I should say."
We all went round to the other side of the deck. There, glimmering white and snowy, enveloped in a delicate rose-coloured mist, rose the glistening pinnacle. I uttered an exclamation of delight. Mrs. Blair ran for her camera. Undeterred by Colonel Race's sardonic comments, she snapped vigorously.
"There, that's the end of the roll."
"Oh," her tone changed to one of chagrin. "I've had the thing at bulb all the time."
"I always like to see a child with a new toy," murmured the Colonel.
"How horrid you are, but I've got another roll."
She produced it in triumph from the pocket of her sweater. A sudden roll of the boat upset her balance, and as she caught at the rail to steady herself, the roll of films flashed over the side.
"Oh," cried Mrs. Blair, comically dismayed. She leaned over. "Do you think they have gone overboard?"
"No. You may have been fortunate enough to brain an unlucky steward in the deck below."
A small boy who had arrived unobserved a few paces to our rear blew a deafening blast on a bugle.
"Lunch," declared Mrs. Blair ecstatically. "I've had nothing to eat since breakfast, except 2 cups of beef tea. Lunch, Miss Bedingfield?"
"Well," I said waveringly, "yes, I do feel rather hungry."
"Splendid. You're sitting at the purser's table, I know. Tackle him about the cabin."
I found my way down to the saloon, began to eat gingerly, and finished by consuming an enormous meal. My friend of yesterday congratulated me on my recovery. Everyone was changing cabins today, he told me, and he promised that my things should be removed to an outside one without delay. There were only 4 at our table: myself, a couple of elderly ladies, and a missionary who talked a lot about our poor black brothers. I looked round at the other tables. Mrs. Blair was sitting at the captain's table, Colonel Race next to her. On the other side of the captain was a distinguished-looking grey-haired man. A good many people I had already noticed on deck, but there was one man who had not previously appeared. Had he done so, he could hardly have escaped my notice. He was tall and dark, and had such a peculiarly sinister type of countenance that I was quite startled. I asked the purser with some curiosity who he was.
"That man? Oh, that's Sir Eustace Pedler's secretary. Been very seasick.
poor chap, and not appeared before. Sir Eustace has got two secretaries with him, and the sea's been too much for both of them. The other fellow hasn't turned up yet.
This man's name is Paget.
So, Sir Eustace Pedler, the owner of the mill house, was on board. Probably only a coincidence, and yet...
That's Sir Eustace, my informant continued, sitting next to the captain, pompous old ass.
The more I study the secretary's face, the less I liked it. Its even pallor, the secretive, heavy-lidded eyes, the curiously flattened head, it all gave me a feeling of distaste, of apprehension. Leaving the saloon at the same time as he did, I was close behind him as he went up on deck. He was speaking to Sir Eustace, and I overheard a fragment or two.
"I'll see about the cabin at once, then, shall I? It's impossible to work in yours, with all your trunks."
"My dear fellow," Sir Eustace replied, "my cabin is intended, A, for me to sleep in, and B, to attempt to dress in. I never had any intentions of allowing you to sprawl about the place making an infernal clicking with that typewriter of yours."
"That's just what I say, Sir Eustace. We must have somewhere to work."
Here I parted company from them and went below to see if my removal was in progress. I found my steward busy at the task.
"Very nice cabin, miss, on D deck, number 13.
"Oh, no," I cried, "not 13. 13 is the one thing I am superstitious about. It was a nice cabin, too. I inspected it, wavered, but a foolish superstition prevailed. I appealed almost tearfully to the steward. "Isn't there any other cabin I can have?"
The steward reflected. "Well, there's 17, just along the starboard side. That was empty this morning, but I rather fancy it's been allotted to someone. Still, as the gentleman's things aren't in yet, and as gentlemen aren't anything like so superstitious as ladies, I dare say he wouldn't mind changing."
I hailed the proposition gratefully, and the steward departed to obtain permission from the purser. He returned grinning.
"That's all right, miss. We can go along."
He led the way to 17. It was not quite as large as number 13, but I found it eminently satisfactory.
"I'll fetch your things right away, miss," said the steward.
But at that moment, the man with the sinister face, as I had nicknamed him, appeared in the doorway.
"Excuse me," he said, "but this cabin is reserved for the use of Sir Eustace Pedler."
"That's all right, sir," exclaimed the steward.
"We're fitting up number 13 instead." "No, it was number 17 I was to have."
"No, 13 is a better cabin, sir, larger.
I specially selected number 17, and the purser said I could have it."
"I'm sorry," I said coldly, "but number 17 has been allotted to me."
"I can't agree to that," the steward put in his oar. "The other cabin's just the same, only better. I want number 17.
"What's all this?" demanded a new voice. "Steward, put my things in here. This is my cabin."
It was my neighbour at lunch, the Reverend Edward Chichester.
"I beg your pardon," I said. "It's my cabin."
"It is allotted to Sir Eustace Pedler," said Mr. Paget.
We were all getting rather heated.
"I'm sorry to have to dispute the matter," said Chichester with a meek smile, which failed to mask his determination to get his own way.
Meek men are always obstinate, I have noticed. He edged himself sideways into the doorway.
"You're to have number 28 on the port side," said the steward. "A very good cabin, sir."
"I'm afraid that I must insist. Number 17 was the cabin promised to me."
We had come to an impasse. Each one of us was determined not to give way. Strictly speaking, I, at any rate, might have retired from the contest and eased matters by offering to accept cabin 28. So long as I did not have 13, it was immaterial to me what other cabin I had. But my blood was up. I had not the least intention of being the first to give way. And I disliked Chichester. He had false teeth that clicked when he ate. Many men have been hated for less. We all said the same things over again. The steward assured us, even more strongly, that both the other cabins were better cabins. None of us paid any attention to him. Paget began to lose his temper.
Chichester kept his serenely. With an effort, I also kept mine, and still none of us would give way an inch. A wink and a whispered word from the steward gave me my cue. I faded unobtrusively from the scene. I was lucky enough to encounter the purser almost immediately. "Oh, please," I said, "you did say I could have cabin 17, and the others won't go away. Mr. Chichester and Mr. Paget, you will let me have it, won't you? I always say there are no people like sailors for being nice to women." My little purser came to scratch splendidly. He strode to the scene, informed the disputants that number 17 was my cabin. They could have numbers 13 and 28 respectively, or stay where they were, whichever they chose. I permitted my eyes to tell him what a hero he was, and then installed myself in my new domain. The encounter had done me worlds of good. The sea was smooth, the weather growing daily warmer. Seasickness was a thing of the past. I went up on deck and was initiated into the mysteries of deck coits. I entered my name for various sports. Tea was served on deck and I ate heartily. After tea, I played shovelboard with some pleasant young men. They were extraordinarily nice to me. I felt that life was satisfactory and delightful. The dressing bugle came as a surprise, and I hurried to my new cabin. The stewardess was waiting me with a troubled face. "There's a terrible smell in your cabin, miss. What it is, I'm sure I can't think, but I doubt if you'll be able to sleep here. There's our deck cabin up on sea deck. You might move into that, just for the night, anyway." The smell really was pretty bad, quite nauseating. I told the stewardess I would think over the question of moving whilst I dressed. I hurried over my toilet, sniffing distastefully as I did so. What was the smell? Dead rat? No, worse than that, and quite different. Yet I knew it. It was something I had smelt before. Something... Ah, I had got it. Asafoetida. I had worked in a hospital dispensary during the war for a short time and had become acquainted with various nauseous drugs. Asafoetida. That was it. But how? I sank down on the sofa, suddenly realizing the thing. Somebody had put a pinch of asafoetida in my cabin. Why? So that I should vacate it? Why were they so anxious to get me out? I thought of the scene this afternoon from a rather different point of view. What was it about Cabin 17 that made so many people anxious to get hold of it? The other two cabins were better cabins. Why had both men insisted on sticking to 17? 17. How the number persisted. It was on the 17th I had sailed from Southampton. It was a 17. I stopped with a sudden gasp. Quickly, I unlocked my suitcase and took my precious paper from its place of concealment in some rolled stockings. 17/1/22. I had taken that for a date, the date of departure of the Kilmorden Castle. Supposing I was wrong. When I came to think of it, would anyone writing down a date think it necessary to put the year as well as the month? Supposing 17 meant cabin 17. And 1, the time 1 o'clock. Then 22 must be the date. I looked up at my little almanac. Tomorrow was the 22nd. Chapter 10. I was violently excited. I was sure that I had hit on the right trail at last. One thing was clear. I must not move out of the cabin. The asafoetida had got to be borne. I examined my facts again. Tomorrow was the 22nd, and at 1 a.m. or 1 p.m. something would happen. I plumped for 1 a.m. It was now 7 o'clock. In 6 hours I should know. I don't know how I got through the evening. I retired to my cabin fairly early. I had told the stewardess that I had a cold in the head and didn't mind smells. She still seemed distressed. But I was firm. The evening seemed interminable. I duly retired to bed, but in view of emergencies, I swathed myself in a thick flannel dressing gown and encased my feet in slippers.
Thus attired, I felt that I could spring up and take an active part in anything that happened. What did I expect to happen? I hardly knew. Vague fancies, most of them wildly improbable, flitted through my brain. But one thing I was firmly convinced of, at 1 o'clock, something would happen. At various times I heard fellow passengers coming to bed, fragments of conversation, laughing good nights, floating in through the open transom. Then silence. Most of the lights went out. There was still one in the passage outside, and there was therefore a certain amount of light in my cabin. I heard 8 bells go. The hour that followed seemed the longest I had ever known. I consulted my watch surreptitiously to be sure I had not overshot the time. If my deductions were wrong, if nothing happened at 1 o'clock, I should have made a fool of myself and spent all the money I had in the world on a mare's nest. My heart beat painfully. 2 bells went overhead. 1 o'clock. And nothing. Wait. What was that? I heard the quick, light patter of feet running along the passage. Then, with the suddenness of a bombshell, my cabin door burst open and a man almost fell inside.
"Save me," he said hoarsely. "They're after me."
It was not a moment for argument or explanation. I could hear footsteps outside. I had about 40 seconds in which to act. I had sprung to my feet and was standing facing the stranger in the middle of the cabin. A cabin does not abound in hiding places for a 6-foot man. With one arm, I pulled out my cabin trunk. He slipped down behind it under the bunk. I raised the lid. At the same time, with the other hand, I pulled down the wash basin. A deft movement, and my hair was screwed into a tiny knot at the top of my head. From the point of view of appearance, it was inartistic. From another standpoint, it was supremely artistic. A lady with her hair screwed into an unbecoming knob, and in the act of removing a piece of soap from her trunk, with which, apparently, to wash her neck, could hardly be suspected of harbouring a fugitive. There was a knock at the door, and without waiting for me to say, "Come in," it was pushed open. I don't know what I expected to see. I think I had vague ideas of Mr. Paget brandishing a revolver, or my missionary friend with a sandbag, or some other lethal weapon. But I certainly did not expect to see a night stewardess with an inquiring face and looking the essence of respectability.
"I beg your pardon, miss. I thought you called out."
"No," I said, "I didn't."
"I'm sorry for interrupting you."
"That's all right," I said. "I couldn't sleep. I thought a wash would do me good." It sounded rather as though it were a thing I never had as a general rule.
"I'm so sorry, miss," said the stewardess again, "but there's a gentleman about who's been rather drunk, and we are afraid he might get into one of the ladies' cabins and frighten them."
"How dreadful," I said, looking alarmed. "He won't come in here, will he?"
"Oh, I don't think so, miss. Ring the bell if he does. Good night."
"Good night." I opened the door and peeped down the corridor. Except for the retreating form of the stewardess, there was nobody in sight. Drunk. So that was the explanation of it. My histrionic talents had been wasted. I pulled the cabin trunk out a little further and said, "Come out at once, please," in an acid voice. There was no answer. I peered under the bunk. My visitor lay immovable. He seemed to be asleep. I tugged at his shoulder. He did not move. "Dead drunk," I thought vexedly. "What am I to do?" Then I saw something that made me catch my breath. A small scarlet spot on the floor. Using all my strength, I succeeded in dragging the man out into the middle of the cabin. The dead whiteness of his face showed that he had fainted. I found the cause of his fainting easily enough. He had been stabbed under the left shoulder blade. A nasty, deep wound. I got his coat off and set to work to attend to it. At the sting of the cold water, he stirred, then sat up. "Keep still, please," I said. He was the kind of young man who recovers his faculties very quickly. He pulled himself to his feet and stood there swaying a little.
"Thank you. I don't need anything done for me."
His manner was defiant, almost aggressive. Not a word of thanks. Of even common gratitude. "That is a nasty wound. You must let me dress it."
You will do nothing of the kind."
He flung the words in my face, as though I had been begging a favour of him. My temper, never placid, rose. "I cannot congratulate you on your manners," I said coldly. "I can at least relieve you of my presence." He started for the door, but reeled as he did so. With an abrupt movement, I pushed him down upon the sofa. "Don't be a fool," I said unceremoniously. "You don't want to go bleeding all over the ship, do you?" He seemed to see the sense of that, for he sat quietly whilst I bandaged up the wound as best I could. "There," I said, bestowing a pat on my handiwork, "that will have to do for the present. Are you better tempered now, and do you feel inclined to tell me what it's all about?"
"I'm sorry that I can't satisfy your natural curiosity."
"Why not?" I said, chagrined. He smiled nastily.
"If you want a thing broadcast, tell a woman. Otherwise, keep your mouth shut."
"Don't you think I could keep a secret?"
"I don't think. I know."
He rose to his feet. "At any rate," I said spitefully, "I shall be able to do a little broadcasting about the events of this evening."
"I've no doubt you will too," he said indifferently.
"How dare you?" I cried angrily. We were facing each other, glaring at each other with the ferocity of bitter enemies. For the first time, I took in the details of his appearance, the close-cropped dark hair, the lean jaw, the scar on the brown cheek, the curious light grey eyes that looked into mine with a sort of reckless mockery, hard to describe. There was something dangerous about him. "You haven't thanked me yet for saving your life," I said with false sweetness. I hit him there. I saw him flinch distinctly. Intuitively, I knew that he hated above all to be reminded that he owed his life to me. I didn't care. I wanted to hurt him. I had never wanted to hurt anyone so much.
"I wish to God you hadn't," he said explosively. "I'd be better dead and out of it."
"I'm glad you acknowledge the debt. You can't get out of it. I saved your life, and I'm waiting for you to say thank you." If looks could have killed, I think he would have liked to kill me then. He pushed roughly past me. At the door, he turned back and spoke over his shoulder.
"I shall not thank you, now or at any other time. But I acknowledge the debt. Some day I will pay it."
He was gone, leaving me with clenched hands and my heart beating like a mill race. Chapter 11. There were no further excitements that night. I had breakfast in bed and got up late the next morning. Mrs. Blair hailed me as I came on deck. "Good morning, gypsy girl. Sit down here by me. You look as though you hadn't slept well." "Why do you call me that?" I asked as I sat down obediently. "Do you mind?" "It suits you somehow. I've called you that in my own mind from the beginning. It's the gypsy element in you that makes you so different from anyone else. I decided in my own mind that you and Colonel Race were the only two people on board who wouldn't bore me to death to talk to." "That's funny," I said. "I thought the same about you, only it's more understandable in your case. You're such an exquisitely finished product." "Not badly put," said Mrs. Blair, nodding her head. "Tell me about yourself, gypsy girl. Why are you going to South Africa?" I told her something about Papa's life work. "So, you're Charles Bedingfeld's daughter. I thought you weren't a mere provincial miss. Are you going to Broken Hill to grub up more skulls?" "I may," I said cautiously. "I've got other plans as well." "What a mysterious minx you are. But you do look tired this morning. Didn't you sleep well?" "I can't keep awake on board a boat. 10 hours sleep for a fool, they say. I could do with 20. She yawned, looking like a sleepy kitten. "An idiot of a steward woke me up in the middle of the night to return me that roll of films I dropped yesterday. He did it in the most melodramatic manner. Stuck his arm through the ventilator and dropped them neatly in the middle of my tummy. I thought it was a bomb for a moment." "Here's your colonel," I said, as the tall, soldierly figure of Colonel Race appeared on the deck. "He's not my colonel particularly. In fact, he admires you very much, gypsy girl, so don't run away." "I want to tie something round my head. It'll be more comfortable than a hat." I slipped quickly away. For some reason or other, I was uncomfortable with Colonel Race. He was one of the few people who were capable of making me feel shy. I went down to my cabin and began looking for something with which I could restrain my rebellious locks. Now, I am a tidy person. I like my things always arranged in a certain way, and I keep them so. I had no sooner opened my drawer than I realized that somebody had been disarranging my things. Everything had been turned over and scattered. I looked in the other drawers and the small hanging cupboard. They told the same tale. It was as though someone had been making a hurried and ineffectual search for something. I sat down on the edge of the bunk with a grave face. Who had been searching my cabin, and what had they been looking for? Was it the half sheet of paper with scribbled figures and words? I shook my head dissatisfied. Surely that was past history now. But what else could there be? I wanted to think. The events of last night, though exciting, had not really done anything to elucidate matters. Who was the young man who had burst into my cabin so abruptly? I had not seen him on board previously, either on deck or in the saloon. Was he one of the ship's company, or was he a passenger? Who had stabbed him? Why had they stabbed him? And why, in the name of goodness, should cabin number 17 figure so prominently? It was all a mystery, but there was no doubt that some very peculiar occurrences were taking place on the Kilmorden Castle. I counted off my fingers the people on whom it behooved me to keep watch. Setting aside my visitor of the night before, but promising myself that I would discover him on board before another day had passed, I selected the following persons as worthy of my notice. 1. Sir Eustace Pedler. He was the owner of the mill house, and his presence on the Kilmorden Castle seemed something of a coincidence. 2. Mr. Paget, the sinister-looking secretary, whose eagerness to obtain cabin 17 had been so very marked. N.B. Find out whether he had accompanied Sir Eustace to Cannes. 3. The Reverend Edward Chichester. All I had against him was his obstinacy over cabin 17, and that might be entirely due to his own peculiar temperament. Obstinacy can be an amazing thing. But a little conversation with Mr. Chichester would not come amiss, I decided. Hastily tying a handkerchief around my hair, I went up on deck again, full of purpose. I was in luck. My quarry was leaning against the rail, drinking beef tea. I went up to him. "I hope you've forgiven me over cabin 17," I said with my best smile. "I consider it unchristian to bear a grudge," said Mr. Chichester coldly. "But the purser had distinctly promised me that cabin." "Pursers are such busy men, aren't they?" I said vaguely. "I suppose they're bound to forget sometimes." Mr. Chichester did not reply. "Is this your first visit to South Africa?" I inquired conversationally.
"To South Africa, yes. But I have worked for the last 2 years amongst the cannibal tribes in the interior of East Africa."
"How thrilling! Have you had many narrow escapes?"
"Escapes?"
"Of being eaten, I mean."
"Oh, you should not treat sacred subjects with levity, Miss Bedingfeld."
"I didn't know that cannibalism was a sacred subject," I retorted, stung. As the words left my lips, another idea struck me. If Mr. Chichester had indeed spent the last 2 years in the interior of Africa, how was it that he was not more sunburnt? His skin was as pink and white as a baby's. Surely there was something fishy there. Yet his manner and voice were so absolutely it. Too much so, perhaps. Was he, or was he not, just a little like a stage clergyman? I cast my mind back to the curates I had known at Little Hamsley. Some of them I had liked, some of them I had not, but certainly none of them had been quite like Mr. Chichester. They had been human. He was a glorified type. I was debating all this when Sir Eustace Pedler passed down the deck. Just as he was abreast of Mr. Chichester, he stopped and picked up a piece of paper which he handed to him, remarking,
"You dropped something."
He passed on without stopping, and so probably did not notice Mr. Chichester's agitation. I did. Whatever it was he had dropped,
Its recovery agitated him considerably. He turned a sickly green and crumpled up the sheet of paper into a ball. My suspicions were accentuated 100-fold. He caught my eye and hurried into explanations.
A fragment of a sermon I was composing, he said with a sickly smile.
Indeed, I rejoined politely. A fragment of a sermon, indeed. No, Mr. Chichester, too weak for words. He soon left me with a muttered excuse. I wished, oh, how I wished, that I had been the one to pick up that paper and not Sir Eustace Pedler. One thing was clear. Mr. Chichester could not be exempted from my list of suspects. I was inclined to put him top of the three. After lunch, when I came up to the lounge for coffee, I noticed Sir Eustace and Paget sitting with Mrs. Blair and Colonel Race. Mrs. Blair welcomed me with a smile, so I went over and joined them. They were talking about Italy. But it is misleading, Mrs. Blair insisted. Aqua calda certainly ought to be cold water, not hot.
You're not a Latin scholar, said Sir Eustace, smiling.
Men are so superior about their Latin, said Mrs. Blair. But all the same, I notice that when you ask them to translate inscriptions in old churches, they can never do it. They hem and haw and get out of it somehow.
Quite right, said Colonel Race. I always do.
But I love Italians, continued Mrs. Blair. They're so obliging, though even that has its embarrassing side. You ask them the way somewhere, and instead of saying, first to the right, second to the left, or something that one could follow, they pour out a flood of well-meaning directions, and when you look bewildered, they take you kindly by the arm and walk all the way there with you.
Is that your experience in Florence, Paget?